Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Around the world, really nearly everywhere but the U.S., May the 1st is a big deal. It's called International Workers' Day, or May Day. Here in the U.S., it's called This Coming Wednesday. Last year, it was observed in Moscow's Red Square with an orderly parade. In the Philippines, protesters burned President Rodrigo Duterte in effigy. While in Paris, over 200 were arrested when anarchists crashed May Day rallies there. On our shores, it was decidedly more quiet, although thousands did march in Puerto Rico to protest austerity measures after altercations with police. But really, you'd think the U.S. had very little to do with May Day. In fact, we created it. Donna Haverty Stack is a professor of history at Hunter College at the City University of New York. She's also the author of America's Forgotten Holiday, May Day and Nationalism, 1867 to 1960. When we spoke to her last year, she began the story in 1886. Labor unions had been fighting for the 8-hour workday for years and years, but they'd only been winning battles city by city. They needed a new strategy.
This was the era of the Second Industrial Revolution, the rise of corporate capitalism. They needed to come together, and so that was the goal for 1886.
Why did these labor unions, going for that big push, choose May 1st?
For the building trades, May 1st was the date when the annual contracts were renewed. The goal was they begin organizing in 1884, making demands. Hopefully, they would succeed. And they would celebrate on May 1st, 1886. If they did not succeed, they held out the threat of striking on May 1st, 1886, which in many cases happened. Once that date was chosen, the more traditional trade unionists and the anarchists and socialists who have a broader revolutionary goals also tap into the associations of May Day with the spring rites, with gathering flowers, with bringing in the green. With
what do the spring rites have to do with labor?
Nothing. But they use it in their iconography, in poetry, in plays, and things that become central to the annual anniversary.
So now it's May 1st, 1886. 80,000 people march in Chicago, 30,000 in Baltimore. How many in New York?
30,000 in New York, St. Louis, Baltimore, Akron, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, all across the country, workers came out. Union leaders giving speeches and anarchists. Albert Parsons, a well-known anarchist in Chicago, was at the head of the march with his wife, Lucy Parsons. They almost didn't participate because initially when they heard of this movement for the eight-hour day, they felt it was
too small,
not what they really wanted, which was revolution. But when they saw the momentum, they realized that's where the workers were. They needed to be out in front of it, at the front of the parade.
But it's the anarchists that get even more closely associated with it. Even in our editorial meeting when we were discussing this, someone raised the Haymarket Affair that happened a few days after May Day. You note that that association is a manipulation. It's purposefully wrong.
It was a peaceful protest in Haymarket Square in Chicago, organized by local anarchists in response to the police killings of six strikers on May 3rd. And initially, I think about 1,000 people gathered. And as the evening wore on and it started to rain, their numbers dwindled down to about 300. One of the anarchists was speaking on a wagon. And when the police came into the square to order the meeting to disband, there was concern that some of the speech may have been inflammatory. Someone threw a bomb into the square. The bomb killed one police officer immediately. Six other policemen died subsequently of their wounds, most likely from the bullets. The police began firing indiscriminately. Eight anarchists were arrested and tried and convicted for conspiracy, four of whom were executed, and they became martyrs to the anarchist cause.
So it was the anarchists that tried to link the two events.
The anarchists conflated the two. Socialists embraced that as well because I think they shared a concern about the reactionary nature of the state and if it were not won over by workers. Workers would never find justice. There was sympathy and support for the anarchists in that moment. Samuel Gompers came out to their defense. He became the head of the American Federation of Labor in December 1886. But Gompers and the AFL and the craft unions that became affiliated with that quickly came to realize that the association with May 1st and Haymarket didn't necessarily help them advance their goals because they were attempting to get public support for the existence of unions. Mm-hmm. And so it was very easy for employers and more conservative Americans to smear the labor movement as illegitimate by associating it with the anarchists.
May Day itself seemed to have become associated with red organizations, communism. Many might have guessed that the entire holiday was invented in Moscow.
Yes, exactly. May 1st takes on an international component earlier than you might think. In 1889, when socialists are meeting in Paris, representatives from the AFL attended and spoke of May 1st, 1886. Even though it didn't secure the eight-hour day forever, the struggle continued. Pulling workers together in a united demand was appealing to the socialists in Europe. And they said, you know what? Starting in 1890, we're going to do the same thing. And European socialists began to use May Day, May 1st, for their labor demands.
And so it continues to this day, unlike here.
Exactly. By 1903, the AFL doesn't want to go near May Day with a 10-foot pole. It's been urging its members to turn out instead on the September Labor Day.
So what's the difference between May Day and Labor Day?
Well, May Day was becoming known as International Workers' Day in the 1890s. Labor Day began in 1882 here in New York, launched by Matthew McGuire, who was a machinist and a socialist from Brooklyn who had a very radical vision.
So it was a precursor
yes.
to May Day.
Yes. And had nothing to do with the eight-hour day. It had, in essence, a more broader utopian vision. It starts out radical, but the AFL rises and it takes over this event and shapes it to suit its own goals.
But how did its message differ from May Day?
The AFL termed Labor Day Labor's National Day. There was very much an emphasis on the national connection, that these workers who turned out on Labor Day were patriotic, were American, and it becomes part of the AFL distancing itself from May Day, which was becoming known as International Workers' Day.
There's another holiday that we roundly ignore that is marked on May 1st. That's Loyalty Day.
Loyalty Day emerges post-World War II, May 1st is chosen specifically to counter any attempts to revive radical May Day demonstrations. The veterans of foreign wars took the lead. They were supported by different fraternal organizations, the Catholic Church, John Birch Society, and spoke in the newspaper coverage of how they were seeking to walk the communists off the streets. They worked with city officials to have the supporters of Loyalty Day get the parade permits. Mm-hmm. And so Loyalty Day becomes a part of the way in which the history of May Day in the United States is forgotten. It's a part of the story of this construction of a Cold War Americanism.
How long does it last?
By the mid-50s, the Communist Party and the left-led unions dwindled due to the prosecution of the Communist Party leaders under the Smith Act in 1949.
They didn't take to the streets, so there was no need to counter them.
Right, and the workers in the left-led unions really struggled with this. I have really dramatic accounts of workers in District 65 here in New York, which was a union that was left-led and had ties to the Communist Party. And
what did they do?
Retail, wholesale, and warehouse workers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really moving account. In 1946, District 65 workers were holding a meeting and they were debating, you know, can we continue to support these May Day parades? You know, the union was facing pressures on all sides to purge its ranks of communists. But one worker said at this meeting, "Most labor people know that May Day started in America. Therefore, I think that we should study more about these May Day parades and labor history and make sure that we know before we can accuse ourselves and our labor of following some foreign ideology or stuff like that. I think that May Day is our day, and we have to point out to the wealthy people in America that we are united and we will stop them from exploiting us. Hmm. And so there was real passion. I mean, these workers had that memory, and they hadn't lost it yet in the late 40s.
If we go back to the 1880s, really, just after the Civil War, maybe, there was this struggle to define what it means to be American, what it means to be loyal, what it means to be patriotic.
Yes. May Day existed in that context from the very beginning. Some of them were navigating a hybrid radical American identity. They didn't want to cede control over what the Stars and Stripes meant to opponents of organized labor. They staunchly defended their right to carry the American flag with their red flags. The Socialist Labor Party members in New York in the 1890s passing resolutions that they were going to carry the American flag into Union Square to claim that flag in an era where in 1893, Flag Day becomes a holiday. The Pledge of Allegiance, attempts in public schools to assimilate children of immigrants, anxiety over 25 million immigrants coming to the United States between 1865 and 1920. These workers and these radicals are smack in the middle of that story because they are mostly immigrants.
You were talking about the Socialist Party in New York. Morris Hillquit was the leader of the Socialist Party at the time.
He wrote an editorial that was published in The Call, the Socialist Party newspaper, responding to criticisms launched at the Socialist Party, critics who said, how dare they? How dare those socialists carry the Stars and Stripes alongside the red flag? The red flag is the flag of bloodshed and violence. And Hillquit retorted, the red flag is the flag of brotherhood and that we have a right to carry the Stars and Stripes. And it's those who are criticizing us who long pawns the stars to the trusts and monopolies, and that their stripes were the stripes of prison garb, and the black flag of the pirate was a more appropriate emblem for them. Their carrying the American flag didn't mean they were subscribing to the more mainstream notion of the flag as an unquestioned loyalty to the country. They were carrying it with the goal of trying to make America be true to itself, their understanding of what that meant, that the revolution of 1776 needed to be extended into the economic sphere. They actually felt a duty, in a way, to carry the flag.
When we talk about this perpetual, perennial argument over what is patriotism, Aaron Copland, our quintessential American composer, was wrestling with the issue of patriotism all the time. Theme for the common man.
Yes.
He even wrote a song called Into the Streets on May 1st. Mm. So could you see the tug of war over May 1st, whether it's a loyalty day or a day for labor, a tug of war over America's identity?
I do think you're right. May Day became a bit of a lightning rod around this central issue of who has a right to consider themselves American and who has a right to define what that means. And I say in my book that, you know, these workers who wanted to carry both the American flag and the red flag, they didn't need the Daughters of the American Revolution telling them what that flag meant. They took it up themselves and they gave it meaning that they wanted in the streets on May Day.
Donna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donna Haverty Stack is author of the book America's Forgotten Holiday, May Day and Nationalism, 1867 to 1960. Now, you may have heard us mention Aaron Copland's Into the Streets May 1st when our producer and WNYC's archivists went hunting for it. To use in this segment, they came up empty. It seems it has never been professionally recorded since it was first published in the 1935 Workers' Songbook. And in a moment, you'll hear why. It invokes hammers and sickles, and also it's really hard to sing. But we decided to record it ourselves with the able assistance of our own producer John Hanrahan and WNYC engineer Irene Trudell. Thanks also to Karen Frillman and Jim O'Grady, who lent their voices to our chorus. And without further ado, we present Into the Streets, May 1st.
Into the streets, May 1st, into the roaring square. Shake the midtown towers, crush the downtown air. Come with a storm of banners, come with an earthquake breath. Bells, ring out of your belfries.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen and Sharina Ong. This is Sharina's last week with us. Thank you very much. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.